You and I back together on a very busy show, Friday, February 25th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. We carried part of Governor Ned Lamont's news conference in response to a growing state contracting controversy. State House GOP leader Vin Candelora joined us later in the show to offer his reaction to what the governor said. Quinnipiac University cybersecurity professor Dr. Fred Scholl talked about the dangers of possible cyber attacks during the Russia-Ukraine war. And we also heard on the national scene from Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, President Biden's U.S. Supreme Court nominee.
What we wanted to do today is show you that we take this seriously, give people confidence. We know how to get this right. And I think you've heard this today, that there may be some bad habits that accrued over many, many years, and we're getting it right. This is the budget season. I got to do everything I can to give our taxpayers confidence that it's the first business guy to lead the state in many years. We're making the investments. We're holding people accountable. We got the auditors coming in. We got a whistleblower line. We're doing it what it takes. NOLA's taken over. A whole new group is there.
Do you think she was responsible? I mean, she was overseeing the
OPM
project under their office.
She was overseeing a $24 billion budget in the middle of a pandemic. There's a lot of things going on. No.
Was there any reason to move the school's construction office to OPM other than the fact that Mr. Diamantis wanted to keep that classified position when he also accepted Melissa's offer to become the deputy secretary of OPM?
Well, I can ask, maybe Noel is better to take that. I will tell you, she needed a deputy. She asked for Costa to come over. Costa had been doing the school construction. So I guess in mid-construction, they figured it was better to transition that over. But you have a better answer than that?
Sure. No, thank you for the question. I mean, I think we can look at the past and make some and have some lessons learned in terms of how that process worked. And, some of the benefits of that program continuing to run and operate, whether it was under DAS or OPM, that schools got the services they needed. But obviously there's been some exposure in terms of some processes and procedures that were not followed, and continued review of what the impact of that is.
Was there a policy reason or not to move it? Or was it just that Melissa wanted a certain deputy and that was the condition of getting it?
Well, I think at the time, and I wasn't in this role, and I wasn't with the agency, but at the time, it made sense to, move those functions as the deputy at the time oversaw them. I know there was, there was a lot of discussion around that move, but it happened, and we can, talk about that, for months and months ahead. The point is that it's now been moved back to OPM. We have the construction expertise, and we have, again, taken some next steps to change the program and to strengthen it. So I know there will be discussions, for probably several weeks, and I know the legislature is anxious to also have the conversations, and we're open to all of those. But I think the fact of the matter is that we are restructuring this program. We're building confidence and integrity into the program that we have to help support our towns and municipalities. And I think it's important to remember that largely this program through DAS and previously through OPM is in fact to support our towns and cities. We really strongly believe that this program is about local control. They are making decisions about the schools and the vendors that they select for these projects. We are largely looking to provide them technical support, provide them contractors as they need, but we're overseeing the regulations and the finances of these projects within the confines of state bond funds and other funds. So our role is more limited. I can't speak to that. I was not in this role at that time. I think that, there's a lot of discussion about how that program moved into OPM at the time. And again, I think there's a lot of newspaper articles and other reports on how that occurred. From what I gather, it was an agreement between, the agencies and the governor's office to move forward on that. And again, we've now learned, that it is best situated at this time under the Department of Administrative Services.
So, Governor, did you, or did your administration ask Melissa to leave? Did you ask her to get another job somewhere?
No.
You did not.
Can you tell us
this is totally her
right.
Were you surprised that she's leaving?
I wasn't shocked. There's a lot of back and forth going on right now. It's distracting. She's got, wants to take, get through OPM, get through this budget cycle. Probably figured a fresh start over in East Hartford made sense for her and makes sense for OPM right now.
Do you believe that she properly supervised her deputy, Costa Diamantis, as they worked together for years?
Look, I've got confidence in her as, Secretary of OPM. I think she did a very good job. It's a big agency, a lot of things going on.
Can you share with us in your conversation with her, and obviously we're in the middle of a scandal, how this has impacted her? Did she say that with Hartford?
Governor Ned Lamont being asked by the Hartford Press Corps about the continuing controversy over school construction contracts.
We've shared a lot over the last 3 years, and, she told me it's time to make a move.
Will you feel that it's time for her to make a move?
One second, please.
Do you feel that it was time for her to make a move?
No, like I said, I think Melissa McCaw has been an extraordinary secretary of OPM, but I understood exactly what she was doing and why she was doing it.
So was it a personal choice on her, or was it a professional choice, or was it that she wanted a clean plan?
I don't know, you better ask her that.
Governor, you're in the building. What responsibility do you bear as the head of this administration for anything that
Governor being asked now about any responsibility he feels he bears for this growing controversy.
I think I would bear responsibility if I didn't react immediately. I think I reacted immediately. As soon as we found out about the personnel issue between Costa and Colangelo, we acted on that pretty darn fast. We then went and got Stan Twardy, a former U.S. attorney. I said, I want a complete debriefing on everything that happened here, and I want to make that public going forward. At that same time, we heard about the federal investigation. I told my team, you participate 100%, leave no stone unturned. So if I can do one thing as to give the taxpayers confidence, when I see something wrong, we address it and we fix it.
Joining us right now, State House Republican Leader Vin Candelore, to give his side and his caucus's side of what they heard today, various OPM and DAS officials and Governor Ned Lamont talking about the resignation of Melissa McCaw and trying to do a little damage control, I think, personally, of the situation there. Vin, good evening. How are you?
Good evening. Good. How are you?
I'm good, Vin. Was this round one of damage control today for the Lamont people or not?
Well, sadly, I think it's just more of just reacting to more crisis as opposed to managing a crisis. And so I wouldn't even call it damage control. I think we're still in free fall. To have your budget secretary leave in the middle of budget adjustments in during session is it's hard to kind of spin that as a routine lateral or promotion. So I think this governor has a lot of problems ahead of him.
Couple of things, Vin, that I heard that I jotted down in watching and then replaying the governor's remarks here on the show from Ms. Gilman, Michelle Gilman. She said she used the word, an exposure. There were procedures that were not followed. The governor said, Vin, you probably heard this, we got into some bad habits that have accrued over many years. Okay, but that still doesn't make the situation right, Vin. I don't know. I know you're a businessman. I do this for a living. If we do years of bad habits, we're out of a job.
Yeah, and I think that what concerns me is that this governor is going to attempt to, sort of commit these bad habits and then be the one that's going to serve as the judge and jury over those bad habits and investigate it and say, look, there, I corrected it. I mean, I go back to the test kits that they failed to deliver when they promised they were coming. Well, the way the governor fixed it was he went out and purchased them at retail, and it cost the taxpayers an additional $50 million. So at some point, the legislature needs to step in and get this bleeding to stop and say, enough, we've got to examine these practices, these memorandums of understanding that they continually enter into behind the backs of the public, behind the backs of the legislature. We need to start investigating it and unpeeling it, because it was his administration that supported it. The buck really does stop with him.
Vin, and the guest is Vin Candelora, State House Republican leader. So is there, do you think there is any, have you heard any change, anything different, Vin, over the past few days from the majority party in either chamber that would indicate that they want to look deeper into this, at least in a public way? I know they say, well, you know, there's already a federal investigation, and that's good if there are federal crimes involved. But as you say, the behind-the-scenes process here, is there going to be any real delving into this, Vin, do you think?
I hope so. I mean, there's some indication on the other side that we need to take a look at it, and I think they're starting to get a better understanding, but I'm not confident, and I want to hear that they have an interest in fixing this process. You know, it isn't about let's conduct our own criminal investigation. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is let's look at that memorandum of understanding that allowed for an entire, you know, subset of an agency to be transferred from one department to another in violation of state law, and it was allowed to exist for 3 years despite our objections. Who approved those contracts? What lawyers reviewed those contracts? And how many more are out there? Our office is requesting all of the MOUs, and there's quite a few, and I want a better understanding of it, because if it's being used to circumvent, again, our budget process, our statutory structure, that's a real problem.
And Vin, when you come down, look, people understand you've been in politics for as long as you have. I've been doing it on this side of the mic. There's a general cynicism of people. Yeah, you know, favors are done. It's how government works. But Vin, I think when taxpayers hear that you have cities and towns saying, hey, wait a minute, we decided on the bidder that we liked here, and oftentimes that was the low bidder, and we went through the process. I think, Vin, people get a little angry when at least the perception, and again, I'm very careful to say none of this has been proven, Vin, but at least the perception is there that there was, I don't know, some strong arming, some steering of contracts. I mean, you have this building in Bridgeport here that was $3 million over the second bid. So it really does make people, Vin, I think, a little wary.
Yeah, and whether or not it amounts to a crime is irrelevant. It's whether or not it amounts to a waste of tax dollars. I mean, that's sort of the litmus test that we're looking at. And certainly the feds will determine whether or not criminal activity occurred. But, you know, when we have a bidding process for a reason. We have transparency and freedom of information laws for a reason. This administration has frustrated me for the last 2 years because they have pushed back on freedom of information requests. They try to peel back agencies that are there to review contracts. They've tried to strip their funding. They've tried to shut them down. And now they have their hand caught in the cookie jar, and they're claiming that they're going to be the ones to fix it. I don't trust that, because they've been the ones that have been undermining that whole structure from day one. And so it's time for the legislature to step in, open up the building, put some sunlight on and disinfect the place.
State House Republican leader Vin Candelora, North Branford. Vin, thank you. We'll talk down the road. We appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
Take care. Thanks.
Appreciate it. All right, folks, there you go. And again, I think Vin put it precisely there. Nobody is saying that a crime actually happened here. Nobody's saying that. That's for the feds to determine, you know, after they interview people, issue subpoenas for grand juries. But again, it is, and it's interesting that Vin mentioned what I had mentioned about an hour or so ago on the show. I think, you know, I'm sure that part of the strategy now is for the governor to say, hey, look, I straightened out the mess here. Well, okay, if he does do that, good on him. But why was the mess there in the first place? Look, somebody eventually straightens out the mess, right? Somebody eventually mops up the spilled milk on the floor or gets out the stain remover and fixes the rug. But my concern always is, you know, and this happened, why? Exactly. You know, and again, when I hear things today like, well, we've had bad habits that have been around for many years. Okay, fix them, number one. And number two, identify the bad habits. Number three, identify how long they were around. And number four, point out who allowed those bad habits in the handling of the tax money of the people of Connecticut. Who allowed those bad habits to stay there? Again, you know how this is, folks, because you've seen it maybe in politics in your local city or town, or you've seen it maybe, you know, on your work level. Well, we're supposed to do this, but we just, don't worry about it. Don't sweat it. Everything's fine. Welcoming back to Connecticut today is a gentleman we've had on a few times to talk all things cybersecurity. Dr. Fred Scholl is an assistant teaching professor of cybersecurity at Quinnipiac University. Fred, it's Paul again. How are you, sir?
Yes, I'm good. How are you, Paul?
I'm good, Fred. Well, you know, wish we were talking under better circumstances, but now, we have the real, guns, planes, and bomb war, unfortunately, in Ukraine. But now, Fred, we're reading all about, is Mr. Putin and might the U.S. retaliate with cyber attacks here? What are your thoughts on all this? And is it, Fred, easy? As easy might be defined to knock out somebody's train system or air defenses any sort of utilities. How easy or easy is this or not?
I think it takes a lot of planning and, skilled people to do this. And unfortunately, the Russians have, through the state-sponsored activities and criminal gangs, they've been really refining their skills over the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, they had numerous attacks on Ukraine going back 5-7 years ago, cyber attacks I'm talking about. And I think what worries me is that they have a pretty significant information intelligence campaign and disinformation campaign, and they're using these as significant, covert weapons, in addition to, as you just said, taking out air defense systems and military systems. So those are the sort of three ways that you can be hurt by cyber. And actually, I'm more worried about, gathering intelligence on how to subvert an enemy or an opponent, and also just using disinformation to change their thought process like they did in the 2016 election. So.
And Fred, what about, some people may say, well, geez, don't these companies, these American companies, don't they have the best cyber security here? And Fred, it's not that easy. You and I have talked about this before. It costs a lot of money. And the only people who have what I guess, Fred, is called military grade security is, in fact, the military. I mean, yeah, they have really good security to protect arms and weapons. But a lot of our regular infrastructure still is out there, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I hope this is a wake up call that shows that, there's a lot of people still out there that don't sort of share our ideas on liberal democracy. So I hope that we have more stringent requirements for all these private industries that you were just talking about to implement better cybersecurity. And I've been looking at Twitter. I saw that the hacking group Anonymous, has, at least according to Twitter, has been hacking the Russian Ministry of Defense and claimed some successes in doing that. So it is possible to carry out these kinds of attacks, and we need to figure out better defense and potentially some offense, too, so we're not just sitting around being attacked.
Dr. Fred Scholl, assistant teaching professor of cybersecurity, is the guest. Fred, hang on. We'll be back with you more on what might the U.S. do, what might Russia do, what's the worst-case scenario here. More with Dr. Fred Scholl of Quinnipiac University. First, though, traffic and weather together right here, 336 on WICC. And might we see, unfortunately, on both sides, either side here, maybe yanking the U.S. into it, the use of cyber attacks in this current Russian invasion of Ukraine that could actually end up going further. Quinnipiac teaching professor of cybersecurity, Dr. Fred Scholl, joins us. Fred, what about getting away from utilities and getting away from hard targets like hospitals and things like that? What about financial institutions? How secure, for example, Fred, is my or your or anybody's average bank? How secure are they to prevent any record of what we have on deposit going away?
I think that they've taken, that's one industry that has taken many steps over the last 10 years to, they've hired chief information security officers. There's more enforced regulations in that industry than any other. So I think they're I think they're comparatively secure in, you know, in terms of individual banks. I think what people are worried about are, you know, broad attacks against the whole system. For example, look at that attack on the bridge between the U.S. and Canada, right?
Yeah.
A few people shut down a huge artery of commerce. So I think that's what I would worry about, that, you know, our adversaries are looking for some type of supply chain. So we have the SWIFT banking system that was attacked some years ago by North Korea. Are there other sort of vulnerable, paths that could be attacked that could shut the whole system down? But I'm less worried about these sort of random attacks now than some other people seem to be, because don't forget, any attack that Russia itself sponsors, they're giving away their attack techniques. So I think they might not just be out doing random attacks on banks as an annoyance factor, but I think they're still gathering information. They're looking for the vulnerable weak points. And I think they're also obviously continuing their disinformation campaigns about Ukraine and other things.
So people in your line of work, Fred, if you saw the data or the method behind a certain attack, say, that then gives away, oh, here's how they're doing it, and we have ways to defend against it. So you're saying is they would be very surgical if they did anything.
Exactly. Yeah. Anytime you launch an attack, then you're telling the other, you're showing some new weapons to the other guy, the other side, and then that just improves their defense. So you don't want to throw away, you know, clever new attack strategies for, you know, limited gains without, but I'm concerned though that they're using all the intelligence gathering and hacking to come up with more strategic plans that we need to be prepared for.
Fred Howe and Dr. Fred Scholl is the guest, assistant associate teaching professor of cybersecurity at Quinnipiac. When a system, when a nation, or when hackers, Fred, use a virus or something to get into the system, I mean, I've read these situations, Fred, that it can take from a few days up to weeks, months, and even having to completely replace hardware to clean all that stuff out. This stuff is devastating sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So hackers now are using multiple weaknesses and they're kind of chaining them together to bring down systems. And once this, you know, the system's been compromised, unless you need to have agents out on all of your equipment, you know, monitoring what's going on, and you need to decide which ones have been breached, which ones haven't. And it's a huge months-long process if you have a large, you know, if you have a large distributed organization. Everybody's connected to everybody else, right? So, you know, an attack on one may be creeping into another organization as well. So,
interesting. Fred, a lot of these people, obviously, some are military connected, but I know, and you and I have talked about this before, and just from reading, some of these hackers, Fred, who may be doing this now or planning to do this over the next few days, weeks, or months, or years, some of these hackers are mercenaries, aren't they? Aren't they? In the twisted way, they're incredibly brilliant people who will just work for the highest bidder, right?
Yes, and this is what's happened over the last 5 or 10 years. This whole industry's grown up in countries, like Russia or like North Korea or Iran or others that don't have any other, you know, way for these people to make money. And so they're brilliant computer scientists that are, using their skills. And they're all organized into gangs, since they're not directly working for a Russian intelligence agency or Korean intelligence agency or whatever, then they're sponsored by them, or they're independent gangs that sort of operate without any oversight or, law enforcement in these sort of rogue regimes.
Fred, finally, as we wrap up here, what is the biggest fear that you have in this, and what should America be, you know, afraid of? Not crazy out of control, but know that something, one or two things is a definite possibility. What would be your biggest warning here?
Yeah, my biggest worry is this continual exfiltration of personally identifiable information, especially to China and Russia, and this constant intelligence gathering that's been going on. And it's, you know, it's enabling our adversaries or competitors, let's say, to look for those weak links that could be out there. And we saw that with that, protest up in Canada. A few trucks can shut down a huge industry. So that's what worries me, is that people continuously gathering intelligence in the background and, looking for those weak links. And, so we need to be better prepared, and we need to stop this constant flow of information out of our borders.
And Dr. Fred Scholl, thanks. Associate Teaching Professor of Cybersecurity at Quinnipiac University, and he directs the cybersecurity program at the Q. Fred, good to talk with you. We'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Have a good afternoon.
Appreciate it. You too, Dr. Frederick Scholl there, Associate Teaching Professor of Cybersecurity, and he directs the cybersecurity program at Quinnipiac. And what did he say? There's just so much information out there, right? There's everybody. Oh, my God. I mean, just this morning, I paid bills, right? I mean, yes, I do that every so often. Maybe not every month. Sorry. But, every so often you got to pay some bills, right? And, name, address, account number. Okay, debit card. No, oh, don't worry. The debit card is secured. Okay. Yeah, all right. Fine. Okay.
I am truly humbled by the extraordinary honor of this nomination. And I am especially grateful for the care that you have taken in discharging your constitutional duty in service of our democracy with all that is going on in the world today. I also offer my sincerest thanks to you as well, Madam Vice President, for your invaluable role in this nomination process. I must begin these very brief remarks by thanking God for delivering me to this point in my professional journey. My life has been blessed beyond measure, and I do know that one can only come this far by faith. Among my many blessings, and indeed the very first, is the fact that I was born in this great country. The United States of America is the greatest beacon of hope and democracy the world has ever known. I was also blessed from my early days to have had a supportive and loving family. My mother and father, who have been married for 54 years, are at their home in Florida right now, and I know that they could not be more proud. It was my father who started me on this path when I was a child, as the president mentioned. My father made the fateful decision to transition from his job as a public high school history teacher and go to law school. Some of my earliest memories are of him sitting at the kitchen table, reading his law books. I watched him study, and he became my first professional role model. My mother, who was also a public high school teacher, provided invaluable support in those early days, working full-time to enable my father's career transition while also guiding and inspiring four-year-old me. My only sibling, my brother Kitaj, came along half a decade later, and I'm so proud of all that he's accomplished. After graduating from Howard University, he became a police officer and a detective on some of the toughest streets in the inner city of Baltimore. After that, he enlisted in the Army, serving two tours of duty in the Middle East. I believe that he was following the example set by my uncles, who are in law enforcement. You may have read that I have one uncle who got caught up in the drug trade and received a life sentence. That is true. But law enforcement also runs in my family. In addition to my brother, I had two uncles who served decades as police officers, one of whom became the police chief in my hometown of Miami, Florida. I am standing here today by the grace of God as testament to the love and support that I've received from my family. I have also been blessed with many dear friends, colleagues, mentors, law clerks. I could not possibly name all of the people to whom I owe great thanks. But I must mention specifically the three brilliant jurists for whom I had the privilege of serving as a law clerk at the outset of my legal career. U.S. District Judge Patty Saris in Massachusetts, U.S. Court of Appeals Judge Bruce Celia in Rhode Island, and last but certainly not least, Associate Justice Stephen Breyer of the Supreme Court of the United States. Justice Breyer, in particular, not only gave me the greatest job that any young lawyer could ever hope to have, but he also exemplified every day in every way that a Supreme Court justice can perform at the highest level of skill and integrity while also being guided by civility, grace, pragmatism, and generosity of spirit. Justice Breyer, the members of the Senate will decide if I fill your seat, but please know that I could never fill your shoes. To my dear family, those who are here with me now and those who are watching from home, I am forever indebted to you for your love and support. To my beloved husband, Patrick, thank you for being my rock today and every day for these past 26 years. I love you. To my daughters, Talia and Layla, you are the light of my life. Please know that whatever title I may hold or whatever job I may have, I will still be your mom. That will never change. There are so many other people I would love to be able to address and to thank, but time is short, so let me end by sharing an interesting coincidence that has actually meant a great deal to me over the years. As it happens, I share a birthday with the first Black woman ever to be appointed as a federal judge, the Honorable Constance Baker Motley. We were born exactly 49 years to the day apart. Today, I proudly stand on Judge Motley's shoulders, sharing not only her birthday, but also her steadfast and courageous commitment to equal justice under law. Judge Motley's life and career has been a true inspiration to me as I have pursued this professional path. And if I'm fortunate enough to be confirmed as the next Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, I can only hope that my life and career, my love of this country and the Constitution, and my commitment to upholding the rule of law and the sacred principles upon which this great nation was founded will inspire future generations of Americans.